Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. If you can kindly find your seats, we are going to continue with the rest of the program. And please feel free to bring in your coffee and your tea. I can see some of the other audience members are doing so. Okay, so we are going to be getting into the panel discussion. And this panel discussion is going to be looking at investment learnings from other African countries. It's going to be moderated by Daryl Moodley, who is the CEO of Sanlam Investment Multi-Managers. He's been serving on the Actuarial Investment Committee for over 10 years, and he's also a qualified actuary. And Daryl will also have the opportunity to introduce his panelists. Each panel will run for 40 minutes, so that's 30 minutes of actual discussion amongst the panelists, and then 10 minutes will open for Q&A within that 40-minute time allocation. So Daryl, please join us on stage.
Never easy doing the post-lunch slot, but today we've got three esteemed gentlemen joining us to talk about some of the learnings from Africa. So mind me for reading some of the experience, but they've got quite a bit of pedigree. So Paul Robertson, first of all, has over 20 years of experience, currently a co-portfolio manager of Laurium's Africa Equity and Africa Bond Fund, and he joined Laurium Capital in 2009 and has mostly been looking at Africa, ex-South Africa investment opportunities since then. Then we've got Andre Steyn, who is the CEO and CIO of Steyn Capital, and he in fact founded this in 2009. He started his investment management career in 2002 as a dedicated short selling analyst in New York, and he is a qualified CA and CFA and has completed his BCom or Bachelor of Accounting degree at Stellenbosch University. Finally, we've got Kamal Govan, who joined Allan Gray in 2016, and he's an investment analyst looking after the African Equity Fund at Allan Gray, also a Bachelor of Accounting, and he's a CA and CFA charter holder. So gentlemen, thank you a lot. I must say, I don't think a weekend goes by without a discussion over the braai around, you know, what direction South Africa is heading towards. Are we going to be the next Zimbabwe? Are we going to be following the likes of Kenya, Egypt, in terms of the debt issues that they're experiencing, or indeed a lot of the social unrest we've seen in countries such as Nigeria and Kenya recently? So I think there's a lot of learnings one can actually take from the African experience. I'm hoping you can, you know, be able to give us a bit of your insights over the next 30 to 40 minutes. But importantly, over the last two decades, I think the narrative we've heard is around Africa rising and the huge demographic dividend that hopefully will emerge from Africa, but that hasn't been the full story, particularly in the last 10 years. And I think the macroeconomic environment has been probably a huge contributor to that. So maybe let's start with you, Kamal. I mean, your sense of the macroeconomic environment, how has that impacted the Africa opportunity set?
Yeah, it's thanks, Al. Broad question. I guess the big so what for me over this time period has been, as you mentioned, the change in the kind of macroeconomic situation. So, you know, if we go back 15 odd years ago, I mean, the whole world was talking about Nigeria and the demographic dividend. You know, it's going to be this huge oil player, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And fast forward today, and it's been it's just been a disaster, frankly. So the from a macro perspective, I suppose the few themes that we can pull out are, you know, I'm not talking about South Africa now, but large swathes of the continent are very import dependent, and so by definition, their currencies are vulnerable to macroeconomic conditions elsewhere. You know, so if the US catches a cold, Egypt gets sick, for example. So that's the first thing. The second thing is then the policy environment in some of these countries haven't been helpful. To put it mildly. So, you know, it's very unorthodox or very protectionist type of policies, which hasn't harnessed some of the kind of potential that these countries have. And so it's been very difficult for corporates to kind of operate in that environment. It's been very difficult for us to see some of the benefits of that demographic dividend come through. So, you know, just give my panelists a chance to answer, but for me, those are the two big themes that I can pull out over the last decade, 15 years or so.
I'm quite glad that you mentioned the demographic dividend, because it's always nice to be in a room where people understand longevity risk. And we can sort of talk about Africa being the new world. And, you know, clearly 1.2 billion people, 54 countries, 29 exchanges, growing, you know, 2.5 to 3 times GDP growth of South Africa. But, you know, to your question, Daryl, we haven't seen that translating into stock market returns. And I guess the answer is twofold, right? Africa went through this massive outperformance in the first couple of years of the 2000s. You know, people always think that the U.S. market always outperforms. That's not historically accurate. You know, Africa compounded at 44% annualized between 2002 and 2008 versus the U.S., which compounded at about 5%. And we've seen the reversal of that. So point number one is starting, I guess, at a very high level, you know, which you know, obviously cast some aspersions on, you know, some of the things that we see coming out of the U.S. right now. But then, you know, also currency's been a big headwind. You know, since we've been invested in Africa over the past 13 years, the Egyptian pound has gone from 6 to 50 against the dollar. The Naira has gone from 160 to over 1,600 versus the Naira. So that's, you know, certainly been a significant headwind to overcome.
Paul, I mean, maybe over to you while we're on the topic of currency. So I think we've seen extreme currency volatility, not just in Africa, but across emerging markets over the last decade.
Yeah. So,
we know that in Francophone Africa, there's a peg to the euro, and that's worked fairly well. But what are some of the dangers of pegging currencies, particularly in the African context?
Yeah, sure. So you're 100% right. A lot of the damage we've seen has come from currencies. If we look at what the companies are doing on the ground, they're doing what they said they would. They're growing well, they're growing market share, the markets themselves are tiny and they're growing into it. You've got to give it to management. They've 100% done what they said they would do, and even better, and coming off low valuations. But the currency has been the big headwind. So there's a couple of things. There's been a few definite policy missteps. If we look at things like Nigeria and Egypt, they've effectively just maintained their exchange rate at too strong a level. So what you get is they've lost competitiveness. Your inflation, which in the beginning looks good because you pegged, suddenly your inflation blows out anyway because everybody's having to source imports and dollars at the parallel market. So you don't even control that. You lose control of your own monetary policy. It just causes basically a grinding to a halt of any investment into the country, as well as economic activities completely skewed. You're not competitive. You're just on the path to nowhere. And we've seen that very clearly in a couple of markets, mainly Egypt, Nigeria. The West Africa franc seems to be sustainably pegged for now. There's a bit of a control mechanism where half of their foreign reserves of the 8 countries involved are effectively kept by the French Central Bank, and that's just part of the policy that keeps it there. They might have the issue, other issues, but yeah, it's all about the sustainability of that peg. Morocco has a peg as well, which has been pretty sustainable because they have the exports, the dollar earnings that have allowed them to maintain that peg. So it varies from country to country, but by and large, we don't like seeing a peg. We'd rather have a bit of volatility, but knowing that we can get our money in and out where we need to, the currency's at the right rate. There is a mechanism if there's a global crisis for countries to become more competitive and to really just kind of get back onto an even keel. Like you would see here in South Africa, the rand blows out, suddenly imports shrink, local manufacturing does well, import substitution, tourism off the charts, and it's kind of its happy days. Africa, I think, still needs to find that happy balance.
Okay, so you mentioned a few countries such as Nigeria and Egypt where currency issues have obviously impacted the investment case, and it's challenging to get your capital out of those countries. Would you, and perhaps Andre as well, would you consider those countries to be uninvestable? And apart from the currency issues, why?
Well, I think perhaps the significant change now is for the first time in 4 years, we have currency liquidity across all the markets we're invested in. The only market with significant currency restrictions currently is Zimbabwe. There are some markets where it's a little bit harder to source dollars, but then you know you have to be innovative. You move it to rands, to euros, to pounds. You know, such is the life of an African fund manager that you can't just sit there and do nothing. You've got to be a little bit innovative. I think it's important to learn from these currency pegs, right? Many other currencies globally are pegged as well. You know, the Hong Kong dollar is pegged. The Chinese yuan is not pegged, but it is. So it's important to think about them. And I think, you know, that West African peg is actually quite a strong peg because the French government guarantees the convertibility of the currency. Nigeria and Egypt would kill for that, right? So even the three countries that left the ECOWAS, the Economic Union, still maintain that currency peg. And it's because eight countries share one central bank. So, you know, it's almost like leaving the euro. That would be very, very hard to do. Doesn't mean that it can't happen. Morocco used to be part of that peg, isn't anymore. Algeria, Tunisia, so it has happened. But it's something that we keep a very, very close track of. And I think, again, doing this, experiencing this in Africa has forced us to do it in other markets as well. You know, so we do things like look at cross-currency Bitcoin rates to detect whether there's any movement away in more than one standard deviation from what we would typically expect. And that's been quite a nice precursor to some of this currency tightness.
Okay, yeah. I mean, so if we now relate some of the parallels of the experience you've had in Africa to, in particular, the South African market, you know, from the perspective of a South African investor, we've had the change in Regulation 28 last year, or the year before, where the dedicated allocation to Africa no longer exists. Has this impacted the way in which you manage portfolios from a South African perspective, and is the opportunity set still valid?
That's a good question. So I think, look, there is certainly more pressure to kind of make this African investment case more explicit now. If you have the whole world to invest in, and you know you've got certain risks in South Africa which you want to use your offshore portfolio to kind of mitigate or hedge, Africa is you know you'd say it's more similar to SA than kind of the developed world, if you like. So that's one perspective. But the flip side of that is, look, it is a unique investment opportunity, and with it comes almost uncorrelated risk in a way, right? So I know some of these big issues we spoke about have been headwinds for a while, but you know, Africa doesn't necessarily move with the rest of the world. Maybe it's because sentiment is so low and it's so beaten down. But if you're looking for a long-term opportunity at seriously depressed valuations and something different in the portfolio, there's certainly a case for Africa to hold some share of that Reg 28 allocation. Certainly the way we think about it. But you know, I think when you open the door to the rest of the world and you don't have a dedicated kind of 5% or whatever to Africa, it certainly sharpens the pencil a bit.
Yeah. I think there's also maybe a slight misnomer back to the currency side, that a weaker currency than the dollar means you're not going to get good dollar returns. That's not true. I mean, as Andre mentioned earlier, you saw those returns we had more than a decade ago, 20 years ago, from Africa. If we look at, for example, the Africa sovereign euro bonds, excluding South Africa, just rest of Africa, for the last 15 years, you've got about just under 7.5% CAGR. So 7.5% per year in dollars for the last 15, 16 years from a basket of Africa sovereign euro bonds. You've been paid about 6% a year in dollars from high yield, global high yield, and 5% from the MB. So there's a bit of risk. There's going to be some volatility, but valuation comes into play. So we believe you are being paid to take that risk, a bit of extra volatility, and a lot of the time, perceived risk is a lot higher than actual risk. You definitely are getting paid, despite what coming. We've used some kind of wounded Africa fund manager, negative speaker, somewhat wounded by the currencies and that. But actually the returns, that doesn't mean you've had poor returns. You've had some great returns. If you look over the last 5 years, since just before COVID, those Africa euro bonds have given you about 12% overall, a basket of Africa euro bonds. you're down about 4% if you invested in the US Treasuries, 7 to 10 year Treasury, which is supposedly safe haven. So I believe at least you definitely are getting paid to take on what is perceived to be that extra risk. And just because you're in a currency, like Rand even, that's maybe weakens year by year against the dollar on average, doesn't mean your returns can't be there.
Yeah. I mean, Paul, so a lot of what you allude to circles around the cost of capital in Africa as well. I mean, a lot of investors can simply invest into government bonds earning 15, 20, 25% and effectively sit on your hands. You know, there isn't a need to invest in African equity. How do you look at that from a capital allocation perspective?
It's definitely a factor. I mean, if we look at the flows, Kenya for the last two decades has run at about 20%. Their pension funds have had about 20% exposure on average to equities. Starting kind of, I guess, with COVID and then with Russia, the central bank started raising rates in the last couple of years fairly aggressively. Pension funds just decided out of equities into treasury bills, treasury bonds. So they, those Kenyan pension funds are now at about 8% exposure. So it's definitely a huge factor, into not just how we look at it, cost of capital, obviously, you've got to build that in, but flows, what the locals are doing to a big degree, as well as what foreigners may be doing. So for us, that's actually, it's a bullish thing. We can't see them going much lower from here. We are seeing them starting to pick up again as those interest rates start coming off in Kenya, which they have started. There was an interest rate cut yesterday. You are going to see locals moving back into equities. Foreigners have started moving back in as well. So it's going to give it, I think, quite a kind of couple of years of impetus.
Well, I think other important point is that the bond vigilantes have moved into Africa, right? The African euro bonds, to your point, were yielding in the single digits. And then, you know, as the US Fed started lifting off, you know, raising rates by the sharpest gradient in history, those euro bond yields spiked up to the mid-teens, some of them, you know, even higher than that. And that had to drive change. It had to drive reform. And so that's what you've seen probably most pronounced in Nigeria, where you know, you saw a reversal of the oil subsidy, which has somewhat snuck back. But you also saw a new central bank chief, 120 people fired from the central bank. So you see some real change being forced by the inability of these governments to actually raise money at those high rates. And that has actually brought some of this Eurobond debt down and led to currency liquidity, as I mentioned, for the first time in many, many years. And I think that's interesting. You know, Nigeria had currency illiquidity for 4 years. Can you imagine how tough it is to run a company if you can't get currency in the door at the official rate, but you still have to honor contracts at the official rate? And there's a variety of companies that really ran into great difficulty doing that. But I think we've got quite a significant change now.
So, I mean, the cost of capital argument is an important one, and particularly when one looks at South African bonds and how yields have escalated over the last 2 to 3 years. And if one were to draw parallels to many markets in Africa where the same has happened and you've got depressed equity valuations, would you consider the South African equity market to potentially be in a value trap?
Sure. That's
despite what Kevin said earlier on around around, you know, the cost of capital potentially coming down this year.
I think you rightly point out that this increase in the cost of capital in Africa is clearly visible in the valuations of the stocks in our universe, right? So for perspective out there, if any of you are bored, go look what Nigerian banks trade at. It's somewhere between 1 and 3 times earnings, right? I mean, APSA, Nedbank, Stanbank, somewhere between 8 and 12 times earnings on average. And that's investor sentiment, but also the cost of capital being very high. So I think, do we expect that to happen in SA, and is SA a value trap? I really don't expect that to happen in South Africa. There are a few reasons why we are different, which I'll unpack now. But it's certainly a lesson. It's a lesson to say that, well, if a government or a policy in a country bleeds a certain direction and continues unabated, you know, the cost of capital and investors will let you know what the cost of capital is, and you'll see it in the valuations. But a few things are in South Africa's favor, I would say. One, we have a very strong corporate sector and you know, just an established manufacturing base. The other big thing we have here is we have a free press. Right, and that it's good to get the information out there. It's good to challenge politicians. I know you can argue this point a bit, but that's not the case everywhere on the continent, and so a lot gets lost in that. I think there are certainly value traps in South Africa, but I wouldn't classify the market as a value trap.
I'd add to that to say that I think many of these African markets have pension fund industries that aren't nearly as large or sophisticated as South Africa's. You know, so you may already mentioned Kenya, but in Nigeria as well, Nigerian pension funds only invest single-digit percentages of their books into equities. And so, that's very, very different from South Africa. And then, taking it down to the micro level, I would say that as long as you're investing in companies that are generating cash and moving earnings forward, our mental model there is that you're accreting value at the free cash flow yield. And in South Africa, there's many mid-caps trading at, 10, 11% plus free cash flow yields, which you find attractive. But I guess Africa is also really interesting. If you just take one micro example, virtually all of our South African banks that have exposure to Africa are more bullish their African exposure than their SA exposure. And the interesting thing is, if you look at Standard Bank, at Absa, they all have listed subsidiaries trading in, Kenya, Nigeria for Stanbic, Uganda, and the like. And you're able to access those equities at a 50% discount to the South African valuation. And that's not an isolated example. That's the same for many of the international telcos as well. And, being able to buy what these companies are calling the best parts of their businesses at discounts, strikes us as being immensely attractive.
Yeah. Andre, you've mentioned quite a few South African counters that you obviously look at. And given that you manage portfolios across South Africa and the rest of Africa, how is your approach to risk management and governance differed, given the relative immaturity of many of those markets?
Yeah, so we do manage money in South Africa, Pan-Africa, and then global frontier and emerging markets. Gives us quite a broad overview of many of these less efficient markets. First off, I would say that corporate governance in South Africa and Africa, actually very good. China, terrible. Turkey, terrible. There's many of these markets where you have to explain to them that it's not okay to lend money to your related party parent at a preferential rate. So I think first off, I'd kind of cite that, and then, well, how do we manage it? We try to qualitatively pick up as much as we can. I think we're known in the market for doing a lot of forensic accounting analysis, and oftentimes what you can see out of the books, is pervasive of a poor culture, and we sort of saw that, at EOH and at the old Pinnacle Technology, where they, the accounting was poor, but they bribed a colonel in the South African police force. Now, that's not your first bribe. Trust me, you don't start by bribing a colonel in the police force. You kind of work your way up to that. And so using those filters, I think, is helpful. We're not going to catch all of them. We do make mistakes, but, on average, it's been very helpful doing that. And obviously, then we pull it back to the company to say, look, if there's something that's awry, we're gonna approach them. That's more successful in South Africa, where we've had companies recently. The last year, there's a company that replaced their chairperson because there were some issues that we point out with the chair, which is very impressive, for the company to do that. In Africa, it's a bit more of a slog, but we're still trying. We're going to be active in these markets for a long period of time. We want to make a difference.
Okay. So, we've talked about risk management, governance. Of course, we know in the South African market there's been a lot of landmines over the last few years. There's been EOH, Steinhoff, there's been Tongaat. Are there any examples? Maybe we'll start with you, Paul. Any examples of landmines that you've hit and some of the learnings that you've
taken out of that? Yeah, lots. No, I think for me, the key thing, the biggest landmines have come not from companies. There are a few, obviously, but have come from just policy missteps. Again, economic policy under the previous regime in Nigeria, and there's obviously democracy in Nigeria. It's a free and fair election, so old guy was voted out, new president came in, but the previous president just had some very strange ideas, very unorthodox monetary policy, which does not seem to work ever. And I think that was a landmine, thinking they're not going to go through with doing something so silly, pegging their currency at such a rate, having a fuel subsidy that just completely made Nigeria actually short oil, basically. So the extent it was. When Nigeria got rid of their fuel subsidy, you saw people protesting and rioting in neighboring countries, because basically the petrol was coming in, was a quarter of the price it should have been in Nigeria and was just going straight out over the borders. So Cameroon motorbike drivers started protesting when Nigeria got rid of their fuel subsidy. Just crazy things like that. So I think for me, that's the biggest thing. Maybe a company-wise, for me, the one up, hopefully none of you guys own the company. There's a company called Choppies, which we actually have owned previously. Then we didn't own, and there was a bit of an accident there, a lot of governance issues. I mean, there's no one's gone to jail. There's been no proof of any wrongdoing, but there's a lot of question marks for us. That's the one I think that we probably learned the most on.
Okay. Kamal, have you got any other better scars?
No, look, we've all got lots of landmines. I think, I'll just add one thing to Paul's comment. You know, it's not only that bad governance is found in an African-listed entity, right? So I won't give names, but there's a company listed on the AIM in London that have African exposure where governance is shocking, right? So these guys are happy to issue shares without consulting shareholders, run the corporate credit card like their personal credit card, get rid of board members willy-nilly. So, I mean, you know, you'd think, oh, listed in London, oh, fantastic. It's not always true. So you got to look for landmines everywhere when you're dealing with this.
Sorry, I'll toss in an example of a qualitative landmine. There's this company in Nigeria, Dangote Cement. It's controlled by Africa's richest man. And you know, there's many things wrong in that entire organization. But I guess the one that sticks out is he used to control this business, Dangote Flour, which is a listed company, very profitable, sold a majority stake to Tiger Brands. It remained listed. And the company immediately went from being very profitable to being loss-making. So Tiger managed, but they sold it to Tiger for $250 million. Tiger managed it for 2 years at big losses, and then sold it back to Mr. Dangote for either one rand or ₹1 or $1, I forget which one, but you know, a lot less than $250 million. And the company immediately, you know, reported massive profits. So either Mr. Dangote is the world's best business person, or he's cooking the books. And so I don't believe a person is honest in one sphere of their life and dishonest in another sphere. You're either a crook or you're not. And so, you know, I would tread very carefully with any of these other listed businesses.
Yeah. So, I mean, that brings up another point around dealing with the state and dealing with government. You know, in the South African context, we've seen issues such as state capture and, you know, there's a huge focus on corruption. In the African context, are there parallels? You know, is it exacerbated and to what degree?
Yeah, I mean, there's, like we've seen in South Africa, UK, various other markets, there's definitely corruption, there's levels of corruption. Some are much worse than others. I think on average things are getting better. There's a lot more scrutiny. You get, interestingly, the IMF is a lot more involved now in Africa, especially since COVID, than it was previously. And that does definitely shine a big light onto what's going on. So that'll help hopefully reduce levels of corruption across the continent. On the debt side, you used to have a lot more bilateral loans, so countries would borrow directly from China or from somewhere else, and you were never sure of where that money was going, what the terms were. There's been a shift towards Eurobond borrowing, which is a lot more transparent, as well as I'd say it's like multilateral loans, the World Bank, IMF. So there's no doubt there's issues like South Africa, but I think and I hope on average things are on the right trajectory. Things are getting better. One more thing. You do have democracy in many of the countries where perhaps kind of a decade or two ago you didn't. So Nigeria, for all its troubles, is a pretty free and fair democracy. Kenya, roughly the same. There have been obviously some teething problems and elections are not always that peaceful, but it's a democracy. And across the continent, we're seeing a gradual shift towards that, except for some of those regions in the Sahel, Mali, etc., which have gone the other way, but they're not a part of our market, really.
Yeah, I was going to say, I agree with Paul. I think scrutiny is the big change over the last few years. But I think there is, you know, the element that I always worry about is that in South Africa, we all here, we live here, we're more attuned to kind of the big things that are happening corruption-wise, or this person, that person, this connection, whereas it can be a bit more difficult when you're sitting here and kind of, you know, keeping your eye out very far north. So it's just something to be aware of.
Well, we read 12 newspapers a day, I'm sure you do.
In between everything else.
And again, sorry, and I'm belaboring a point here, but the investment case all goes back to valuation. Just going down to either country's interest rates or more specifically a company valuation, is all that risk in the price? Kenya, we know, has got issues. There have been some protests. But you're getting companies there. We've got a bank on a just over 2.5 times 1 year forward multiple, great dividend yield. Management over the past while have been doing exactly what they said they would do. Something like that. So we think that's in the price. It's in the value. There's a lot of upside, irrespective of it's built into the valuation, those risks that you mentioned.
Okay. So particularly in the investment industry at this juncture, ESG is a bit of a swear word. So particularly in Europe, you know, the focus appears to be on climate, and in Africa perhaps less so, for good reasons. How are you seeing ESG being applied on the continent, and is there a valid case for it to be applied in terms of a global framework, given the ambition of having a just transition?
Well, I think I've demonstrated that we're very strong on governance, and we do interact on that significantly. As a company, we do 1,500 management engagements a year, and typically around 100 of them are ESG engagements, so it's front and center. In addition to governance, we are also focused on environmental and social. Our portfolios don't tend to be very carbon intensive. You know, we always bill ourselves as quality value investors. We look for high quality businesses. Typically, extractive industries like mines are not high quality endeavors because it's, you know, it kind of works in reverse to what we want the business to work at. It's a declining asset. We want something that's going to build in value over time. But you know, we did have one investment which you know, did have some emissions and emissions growth because of adding generators to cell phone towers, and we, together with other investors, actually interacted with them. They spent $200 million basically reducing their diesel generation capacity, you know, connecting to the grid, rolling out green power, and significantly reducing their emissions. So there's, you know, there's definitely success stories there too, but primarily our focus is on governance.
Okay. Kamal?
Yeah, I think...
differing views from you?
Look, I think ESG is very important. It's always been part of our process, but I think when you apply ESG to an African context, I'd say the S and the G are far more important than the E. I think that's just an observation. It's not to say the E is not important and, you know, we're not worried about that, but primarily our engagements in Africa are typically governance-related. And social aspect, and then, you know, the whole debate, if you want to have, on what's just for a country to do usually ties into the environmental part. So, you know, it can be a bit controversial, but, you know, we don't see too many outliers in the portfolio or too many issues from that perspective. But, you know, you never know. Things can change.
Yeah. And Paul, on the bond side, I mean, is that ever applied given the investment in sovereign bonds and corporates as well?
Yeah, I think it goes back a lot to the governance and the social side. I mean, we hear often we'll kind of come across companies other managers offshore talking about managing an impact fund and showing that what they're doing, and half the time they end up just owning what we own anyway, as we're not an impact fund or anything like that. But any investment that goes into these countries has a genuine, very real impact, whether it be on the bond side, on the equity side. I mean, often we've come across proper impact funds with their portfolio, huge overlaps with our equities, hospital groups, healthcare, financial inclusion via some telcos, things like that. So, I think it was Shainal asked yesterday, geez, don't I have gray hair from looking at Africa for 10, 15 years? And the answer is not really. It's interesting. It's hugely interesting. I enjoy it. And you genuinely do feel that you actually are helping somebody and something, making an impact.
Shainal didn't ask me that. Maybe he was being polite. I do want to tack on to that just to say that, you know, over the past couple of years, we've seen many of our competitors in this space exit the African markets because it has been difficult, right? Mm. But one of them exited the market and he actually started up an ESG impact fund. So I think he was kind of looking at where the money was flowing and decided, well, he'd rather do that than Africa. But, you know, I think Africa in the 13 years we've been involved in it, yes, it's the market has underperformed the JSE index. I think it's the JSE has done, you know, since 2013, 11% a year, and the Africa's index has done 8.5% in rands. But that's at a 20% correlation. And, you know, I'm sure all three of us on stage have done much better than that, yep. In fact, better than the JSE. So there is, you know, Africa is an immensely inefficient market. And that is what is fun and exciting about it. It does come, or it has come, doesn't mean it's going to continue, has come with some baggage on the FX side, which has meant that we've had to work, I think, a lot harder.
Mm. Yeah. I was actually looking at some numbers on that exact point earlier. Since, I think, the start of 2014, when our fund started, the indices that we track are on average down around about 30% in dollars. So it's been a tough period, but all three of our funds are fairly similar. We've done, I think, north of 30% on a gross basis. So down 30 for the index, up 30 on average, and we've all been very similar. So the markets are inefficient, and there's huge scope for let's call it alpha. You don't just need the beta story, the long term story, the valuation. In such nascent, inefficient markets, there's great alpha to be had as well, as us and many of our peers have shown. Yeah.
So there's obviously the perception that the U.S. will continue growing and Africa will continue kind of dwindling. Perhaps an unfair question, do you think that the Africa opportunity will materialize in our lifetime? Or?
Yeah, I'll start. So I definitely think so. So, and we'll take it back to basics, right? So we have a selection of young, let's call them young and growing companies with very, very attractive starting valuations and currencies that have beaten down. Mm. You can sign me up.
Yeah, I absolutely agreed. I mean, our portfolio trades at 5x earnings growth last 2 years has been 30%. In local currencies, lop off about 10 points of currency. So that's still, you know, 20% earnings growth. It's hard for me to see how that doesn't move forward. And, you know, the demographics point is important, right? I mean, 25 million people a year moving to cities, that creates demand. If you compare and contrast that with, you know, Japan, Italy, Korea, China, I mean, Japan has 8 million homes standing empty. You know, going in back in reverse is not going to be fun.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. And with that, not only growth in demand, but earnings growth for companies. If you plot, for example, just a cell phone company, telecom company, their margins relative to how many people, urbanization in a country, there's a very clear relationship. They having to service less towers out kind of in the rural areas with only one or two users. They can really service a lot more people just with one tower in the city. It has a huge impact. There's a very, very real correlation. So you get that demand, you get your revenue growth, you get accelerating earnings growth on very cheap valuations.
Okay. Thanks a lot. I feel like a school teacher today coming up and asking you guys questions. So I want to ask the rest of the class, do any of you have questions before we get kicked off stage? Andrew.
Thanks. So, I mean, maybe it's a question that you would be wanting to ask others. And the question is, despite what you say, you know, there are a lot of opportunities for alpha and good returns. But even listening to you, there is a lot of stuff to worry about. And as a result, there isn't a lot of money that gets allocated to African portfolios. And it's probably even less after the changes to offshore, where there was that special Africa piece that is now no longer special. You know, how do you get investors to invest more? And Is it just maybe just you need the index to do better so that people think that as an area it's a good investment, as opposed to you as individual asset managers doing better, but people still think it's a basket case because of the index?
Yeah, the consistent question is, when is the beta coming? You know, even though all of us have done well on an alpha perspective, they go, okay, where's the beta? And by the way, I can just buy NVIDIA and, you know, always make 50% of my money. To an extent, we need, I guess, the US to roll over a little bit. One of the things that correlates very strongly with stronger African equities is a weak dollar. By the way, that's also true for emerging markets and frontier markets. President-elect Trump is already talking about a dollar devaluation. So, the dollar is at 50-year highs on a trade-weighted basis. It's 20% overvalued, at least on most fundamental valuation models. So, you know, I think we're a lot... You can never call the bottom, but you can stick your head out the window and say, hey, are we closer to the top or closer to the bottom? We're not close to the top.
Any final questions?
Please, you mentioned that in some of the investment, sort of the companies you're interested in, it's the S and the G that's quite important. To what extent do you work with the companies in helping them in that S and G, and what is the quality of what they are reporting? Because when it comes to ESG reporting, some people are getting it right, some people are not getting it right.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think we like a starting place where there's improvement to be had from, right? So we don't want the perfection. We prefer something baked in the price where there's upside and improvement. And we do. We constantly engage with these companies. Look, in Africa, there is a bit of whether they listen or not. We're not sometimes as big shareholders in these companies as we are in South Africa, for example. We can make a meaningful change. But that doesn't stop us. We're happy to share best practice with them. We're happy to push back on them. We're happy to engage with them, their advisors, whoever may be. We are seeing some green shoots. That's the best way to say it. It's a slow process. It's not perfection yet. And a lot of the things they're trying to do, you know, ESG reporting, for example, if I can pick on something like that, is not the first thing on their mind. You know, running a bank in a country where you're dollar short is the first thing on your mind, for example. And you've got to keep the lights on, and you've got to deal with this minister who's now come up with some other pipe dream. But they're getting there, right? So the point is that they are evolving, they are getting there, things are improving slowly, and we're on the journey with them, especially if we invested in the company and we think there's a lot of upside.
Okay. Thanks a lot for your insights, gentlemen.
Great.
And
thank you.
Hopefully
thanks,
the,
everybody, for listening.
Hopefully the investment case turns around for you very soon.
Thanks, Al. Thank you, guys.
Yes.